Honestly, people ask me, listen, I've won two Super Bowls with the Giants. You're in Australia, correct?
Yes.
Football's the most popular sport in this country. So winning a Super Bowl and winning it twice, that's an amazing thing. Riding in the parade and, working for a team, you have so much more pride. But if somebody asks me my greatest moments, my greatest achievements, what the most amazing thing I ever did in this business, it's the Dream Team. And that'll never change.
And you are in Australia right now.
You're talking NBA basketball. You're talking great teams. You're talking great individual players.
Takes it off, and there's number 23. And of course, Johnny goes nuts.
We're all getting goosebumps thinking about it now.
I just tried to go out there and play my game.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Adam. I don't like anybody. I'm not a people person.
Grant, you made the pass. Yes. Christian, can you catch the ball? Yes.
All the stars were aligned, and all the muscles fired at the right time, and I was able to get off the ground and throw one down.
I was saving that as a surprise for you.
And now, introducing your host for In All Airness, Adam Ryan.
Welcome to episode 85. Thanks for joining me. Today I'm excited to welcome Don Sperling to the show. You would almost certainly be familiar with his remarkable filmography. Michael Jordan Come Fly With Me, NBA Awesome Endings, Michael Jordan's Playground, NBA Superstars, and Michael Jordan Airtime, to name just some of his iconic releases. Don was Senior Vice President and Executive Producer of NBA Entertainment for well over a decade. We talk about its formation and early years. Plus, Don offers specifics on some iconic moments from Come Fly With Me and Airtime. Now, due to the breadth of Don's tenure with the NBA, hopefully he'll join us for a second conversation at a future date. Towards the end of the episode, I'll share another great podcast review. You can add yours by visiting inallairness.com/review. Show notes for this episode, including links to numerous topics covered, are at inallairness.com/85. Now, on to the show. My guest today was Senior Vice President and Executive Producer of NBA Entertainment, NBA TV and NBA.com for 15 years. He's currently Vice President and Executive Producer of New York Giants Entertainment. Don Sperling, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here with you.
Now, you were born and raised in New York. What pro sports leagues did you follow most when you were a youngster?
Yeah, I was your classic, what I call the core four fan of New York sports. I was a Knicks fan, Rangers fan, New York Giants fan, and a Yankees fan. That we kind of called like the core four. After that, some people are like Mets fans, and then they're a Giants fan, or they're a Jets fan, a Yankee fan. Those four teams go with each other. That's the most connected fanship in New York.
Did you attend a lot of games as a youngster in different leagues?
I grew up a Yankees fan. I grew up in the Bronx and Yonkers, so I lived, within 20 minutes of Yankee Stadium. So I went to, hundreds and hundreds of Yankee games. But really, my formative years, I was really fortunate enough that the Knicks turned their franchise around and started to get good when I was, at that age of 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and they won the two championships. Those great teams of Willis Reed and Walt Frazier, Dave the Butcher, Bill Bradley, Dick Barnett, and then later in 73, Earl Monroe. And that was really my first love. That Knick team I fell in love with. They were the best team probably in basketball history, meaning I don't mean it's the best players. There are better teams that could probably beat them. But as far as teamwork goes, guys hitting the open man, playing defense, playing for each other, coaching, that's one of the most legendary classic teams. So I kind of grew up and had my formative years with them.
Did you play any sports when you were growing up as well?
Yeah, of course. I played them all. In school, I played, baseball and basketball, and then I played every street game there is. I grew up in a different era. We played in the Sandlot. We played a lot of baseball. Played a lot of football, played a lot of basketball, street games, punch ball, dodgeball, kickball, stoop ball. Played a lot of city games, So I was always out and about all day long running and jumping and, just growing up like a regular New York City kid.
Gotcha. Now, in terms of your working life, just before we get to how NBA Entertainment first appeared on your radar, do you mind just filling us in a little bit about what got you to that point where that was a possibility for you to start working with the NBA?
Well, I started interning down in Miami in the summers and the winters. My aunt was one of the first pioneers. She was a news director of a news station in Miami, and I used to go down and hang around as a little kid, go out with the sports crew and interview all the players and go to all the practices and stuff. Then when I was older in college, I started interning there, and I realized like I really wanted to do this. I wanted to get into sports television. So I finished school and started looking for work. And at that time, cable was just starting. You know what I mean? There wasn't really any, you know, places like there is. Like now, there's thousands of jobs. Then you could only work at three places, ABC, CBS, or NBC. So I hustled. I mean, I have crazy stories on how I snuck into places and got interviews and got jobs. But I got a weekend gig at NBC Sports, working on, you know, doing the football highlights and, you know, with Brian Gumbel and Mike Adamly. And I worked for Don Oldmeyer there, the legendary executive producer of NBC Sports. And then I got a job at CBS News during the week in the film and tape library as a researcher. So I was in news, really, my beginning. My first job was CBS News, and then CNN started in 1980. And, you know, everyone told me I was crazy. You know, I had a full-time job at CBS in New York. And they said, oh, this drunk sailor is starting a cable news network, you know, meaning Ted Turner.
Yeah, yeah.
Because up until that time, he was only famous for America's Cup. And if I don't know if you remember, there was a very famous press conference when they won America's Cup. He got so drunk, he was crawling under the table and this and that. So they used to call him a drunken sailor that got wealthy. And he started seeing it. And I just looked at it as an opportunity. I didn't think I was going to move up that fast at CBS News. And I moved down to Atlanta, and it was the greatest break of my life. I started writing, producing news. You know, then I moved over into the sports division. The sports department wanted me to work there. And I said, you know what? News is so hardcore. It's so life and death and this and that. And I said, why don't I do something that I know really, really well, that I think I could be the best in, and also have a little fun and work hard, but really enjoy. So I worked for CNN News and then CNN Sports. And then David Stern came calling.
That's a perfect lead-in. How did that opportunity come to be? And do you remember your conversation with David Stern?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, they were licensing out NBA footage and NBA production outside of W&W Films. Barry Winnick, who was one of my also mentors that had the license, they had licensed it out. So David wanted to bring it in-house. He wasn't commissioner yet. He was almost commissioner. Larry O'Brien was. And David was really kind of running the league as executive director of the league. I interviewed with him, and I thought it went pretty well. And I get up, you know, and I say goodbye. I start walking out of the office. He goes, hold up. And I went, oh, no. And he goes, just remember one thing. I said, what? He goes, it's better to be lucky than smart. And I swear to God, to this day, I use that quote, and I think about it. It's great to be smart, but luck is a lot better. With everybody's career, I think luck happens. As you'll see later, I was lucky enough to be around during the golden age of the NBA.
That's fantastic. What were some of the key priorities that you had when NBA Entertainment began, and even what number of staff were there at the time?
Yeah, we had to get charge of all of our footage and license and our games. So we started bringing the licensing in-house, the games in-house. We set up at every arena loggers. We had our own loggers to log all the footage, but we had loggers at every team level, recording the game, putting in simple logs, sending them back to NBA Entertainment. We created a system. This is analog, way before digital, 3/4-inch tape back in the early 80s. And like this is 83, 84. And we brought that in-house. We started producing halftime features for our broadcast partners. And we started working really close with our network partner, CBS, and really starting to produce. We would do some home videos, some championship tapes and stuff like that. You know, basic stuff, but important stuff that put our brand and told our story and try to rebrand the NBA. You know, when I got to the NBA, our finals the year before I got there were on tape delay.
Mm.
Think about that. The Sixers and the Lakers in 1982 was on tape delay. I mean, you couldn't even imagine that. I mean, it's on a 9 o'clock tonight, prime time, you know. And that's not two shabby teams. That's Magic Johnson versus Julius Erving. And so that changed. We started to rebrand and look at, you know, David, you know, on the marketing side and us on the production and marketing side. We started to really pull together. And make our game much more exciting, cutting, you know, those NBA is fantastic spots. And then that eventually became, I love this game. I don't know if you remember those promos.
Oh, certainly. Absolutely do remember those.
Okay. Adam, I know you're a fanatic, but I'm not assuming anything. So I'll just tell the story and you can cut me off if I'm being repetitive. All right.
No way. I won't cut you off. I just love to hear you elaborate on them.
Yeah. So USA Network had the cable deal. We were doing it for them. And then in 84, Turner got the cable deal. So it was Turner on cable. We had ESPN also and CBS. And we started to produce features. And we started to produce, you know, shows and documentaries and then year-ender tapes. And then we got into the home video biz, which really blew up our business with a bunch of different companies, CBS Fox being the most important one, probably. And then, you know, obviously the 1984 finals, which I still say is, you know, for me and for everyone, I still say is the greatest finals of all time, the Lakers and Celtics. Not only had Bird versus Magic, he had the two, you know, probably the two winningest teams in NBA history and the two most natural rivals playing each other in one of the greatest seven-game series. And then that same spring, a young kid out of North Carolina gets drafted into the NBA. I would say 1984 was probably the biggest watershed year in NBA history for a lot of reasons. Great finals, great players, great play. The NBA then took off. And then Jordan, obviously, was, and then, you know, and then you had Isaiah already in the league. And then after that, later on, you know, Charles Barkley gets drafted. You had Julius Erving winning his championship in 83. And all these great players start to come, and we start to make these players superstars. I mean, they are superstars anyway, but we start to feature their greatest plays, their personalities, the face. You realize with basketball, the innate advantage, guys are basically playing in their underwear. Okay. I mean, you know, it's a pair of short shorts and a tank top.
Yeah.
Whereas in football, they have a helmet. Baseball, they have hats on and gloves and it's shot. Basketball is this small sphere and it's shot and the game is continuous and you see the emotion and you feel the emotion and you see the amazing athleticism up close. And we started to utilize and enhance that in everything we did. And our partners did too. CBS Sports did a great job. And everyone down the line. And then you have Converse and then Nike and then, you know, all of our business partners and Gatorade. And, you know, this thing just started to take off, especially with Jordan, because no one had ever seen anybody come on the scene that fast, that quick, with that much charisma and that much ability.
Great background there. Thanks for detailing some of that too. Now, you mentioned the 1984 NBA draft. Given it was held in New York, you're in New York. Do you recall your whereabouts on that day? Because that was one of the most iconic draft classes of all time.
Yeah, it was held at the Felt Forum, Madison Square Garden. And at the time, though, you got to realize, you know, when Jordan was drafted, look, first of all, he's drafted third, okay?
Yeah.
You know, Hakeem Olajuwon was the best. Listen, nobody will ever argue. Everyone's saying, oh, I can't let anyone drafted over Jordan. Hakeem Olajuwon, I mean, look what he did. He was the centers at that time were gold. So if you had a guy with that ability, he was drafted first. Then Portland drafts Sam Bowie. Now that's the gaffe. That's the key. That's probably the biggest mistake in draft history. And then Jordan falls into Rod Thor's hand, who was the GM of the Bulls at the third pick. But no one, listen, you could go back. There's not one person, even Rod Thor, whoever, that really thought that Jordan was going to be that good. You know the famous line, who's the only guy that could hold Jordan under 20 points?
Dean Smith.
Right. Nobody knew. And then once these exhibition games were being played, people were like going like, oh my God, did you see that? Everyone's going, did you see that? We're getting tapes in. We're looking at tapes. Everyone's talking. The buzz was, you know, there's no social media. There's no instant gratification. You had to either read it in the paper or maybe see a highlight on the news. It wasn't like now where people are soaking things up immediately. There was no immediacy back then. So no one really knew. And then the buzz started to go around.
And that's why I guess the importance of these end of season videos, the league produced ones that you were talking about.
Right.
Even to this day, you can watch a lot of those on YouTube. Thankfully, they've made their way onto YouTube and you can see some of these great recaps of seasons past. And I know that one of them in particular, it has a perfect moniker that still exists to this day, Bad Boys.
Yeah.
Came about through the 87-88, I think, recap of the Pistons season. Now, you were involved with that.
Yeah, I had a big argument with David Stern. David Stern used to blame me for all that because I insisted that that should be their name. I mean, the Detroit Pistons were probably the most important team to the growth of NBA entertainment, not to the growth of the league, but to NBA entertainment. Chuck Daly and all those guys, Isaiah and John Sally and Joe Dumars and Ricky Mahorn and all those guys down the line, they let us into their inner sanctum, let us into the locker room, on the bus rides, on the court, wiring, in the huddles. They gave us full access and trusted us, and we didn't burn them. Because before that time, you was always a little skeptical about giving people access, because what if they showed something or played something? We were accepted by them, and then after that, it blew up. Every other team then trusted us, but we grew with that team. And I had a kind of an argument with David about he didn't want to use the name Bad Boys because the connotation, and he didn't want, and the Pistons had a bad reputation of playing hardcore basketball, meaning like, you know, you drive down the lane, you pay for it, which, you know, became the Jordan rules, as you remember. And they were like kind of Jordan's nemesis, you know, they would beat Jordan every year and until Jordan, you know, built up, started lifting weights and convinced Scottie Pippen not to be afraid. Even to my last day at the NBA, David used to point to me, he goes, I should have never let you call them Bad Boys. But we did. And that documentary that was done a few years ago, I don't know if you saw it, they revisited the Bad Boys after 25 years. They did a Bad Boys documentary, the NBA, like a 30 for 30.
Yeah.
You know, all that tape that I shot and everything was all in there, all the interviews and stuff. Yeah, Chuck Daly was a very good friend of mine.
And then you'd also travel with him as part of the Dream Team in 1992, which we'll get to in a little while.
Yeah.
But what a great personality Chuck was on and off the court. He was great for the game.
Yeah, Chuck was the best. I mean, honestly, you know, people ask me, listen, I've won two Super Bowls with the Giants. Okay, I know football. You're in Australia, correct?
Yes.
So, I don't know, NFL football probably isn't, obviously not that popular there. Basketball is more popular. But football is the most popular sport in this country. So winning a Super Bowl and winning it twice, I mean, that's an amazing thing. Riding in the parade and, you know, working for a team, you have so much more pride. But if somebody asks me my greatest moments, my greatest achievements, what the most amazing thing I ever did in this business, it's the Dream Team. And that'll never change. We can win four more Super Bowls. It's not going to change.
That says a lot.
Starting in San Diego, going up to Portland for the Tournament of Americas, then to Monte Carlo, then to Barcelona. I mean, basically traveling 12 weeks, living with those guys on the plane, in the hotels, babysitting their kids, you know, being embedded in the Dream Team. When I look back, I mean, it's just the greatest team ever assembled in the history of all sports. They'll never have a team assembled of that caliber, of that personality, of that stature, of that importance that took international basketball and blew it up. I mean, the reason why you see all these great international players in the game today, Dream Team is the core of that. That was really one of the most, you know, satisfying and important things that ever happened to me in my career.
It's almost 26 years since that took place. Can you put into any sort of context the amount of interest and just how fans would just be lining streets blocks and blocks away just to try and get a glimpse of these players? What was it like to be in amongst that?
You know, it's funny. You know, we had this famous rec room. We were almost like prisoners, so we used to call ourselves in the hotel. Because you could go out, there'd be literally 5,000 people outside the hotel just to watch them walk from the steps to the bus. I mean, seriously, to see each person for 8 seconds.
Amazing.
It was like crazy. But this rec room, I'm sure you've read Jack McCallum's book, which I talked a lot in his book, and I was on a couple of documentaries that NBC did and a couple other people. We used to play ping pong and pool and car. And I'll give you my story with us shooting airtime with Jordan. I'll give you that story in a minute. But we used to play, like, Jordan was so competitive. Jordan, listen, I think LeBron is doing stuff that's legendary and in pantheon thing. I still think he'll be the second best player of all time. Jordan is still and will be the greatest. Unless LeBron wins it this year and then wins another one, then I have to reevaluate.
Yep, certainly fair.
But by the way, they had their window in that game. Thank you, JR. But
that's true, they did. That was unbelievable.
No, you got to steal one game. That was their window.
Yeah.
They're going to probably lose by 12 tonight. But anyway, but that's not what we're talking about. Yeah, so they used to play cards all night, like Bird and Magic and Jordan and Ahmad would be in the room and Spike Lee used to come over and Barkley and all these guys. And but I once was playing ping pong against Jordan. And I'm actually a very good ping pong player. I don't play a lot.
Yeah, okay.
It's just an innate sport for me.
Right.
I always win these like small tournaments, and I actually beat Michael one of the games.
Wow. How did he react to that?
He flipped out. I actually was scared. I actually did not play as hard in the second game. And I wouldn't say I let him win, but it was somewhere in my mind that if I won again, it could have disrupted my entire working relationship on that trip with him. You know what I mean? That's how competitive he is.
Wow.
And crazy. But so our contract to do airtime, Michael had to give us like a day and a half in Barcelona. We already gotten like a half day was just a day of like following him, shooting him, you know, doing stuff. So we shot him playing golf and practice once. And that was like the half. But the full day was the full access, morning through the end of the day. And he agreed that it would be the day of the gold medal game. So the gold medal game is starting at almost 10, 11 o'clock that night. Because in, you know, Spain, is it's earlier in the U.S. or whatever. Okay. He starts playing cards all night. And of course, you know, people work with me a lot, but I'm extremely obsessive. I'm extremely anal. I have to make sure everything is right. So he's playing cards with Magic and all this, and they're teasing him. Oh, Michael, you got your video tomorrow. And I'm standing there like a mother hen the whole night watching. I'm going in and out. I leave. I come back. I leave. I come back. It's going on and on. Now he has to get up at 6:30 a.m. with us and start going. So now it's 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock. And I'm like, tapping my watch, Michael, and he's like giving me the, and at one point I said, Michael, listen, you're not going to get any sleep. He stares me down like I move away. 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, they finally break up the game. So I'm walking him to his room. He goes to his room and I say, listen, don't crash on me. You know, I'm thinking like he's going to go to his room. He's going to fall asleep. He's not going to wake up. You know what I mean? I'm screwed.
Yeah.
He goes, no, just wait out here. Now I'm up all night, but that's fine. I don't care. I'm on juice and I can, and Spanish coffee is amazing, by the way.
Okay.
It's really strong.
Yeah.
That's what got me to drink strong coffee. My 8 weeks in Barcelona. But anyway, so I'm waiting outside his room. I'm saying, oh no. All of a sudden, 6:30, like magic, door opens. He emerges in that Nike had made him that like printed suit. He almost looked like Eddie Murphy Coming to America.
I know what you mean.
If you look at the pictures, it's got his shorts and matching shirt, like a, it was like a crazy like Nike outfit.
Yeah, he wore that in the Olympic Stadium.
We have the van, we go to the NBC commissary, we're eating, all this crazy stuff's going on. We staged this great shot on the main avenue in Barcelona. I don't know if you know that famous sign. He's like up and it pans down to him walking and he's looking at himself.
Oh, absolutely.
And I had made some arrangements, but they weren't firm. We go to Olympic Stadium. And there's like 60 soldiers with rifles standing outside the stadium guarding. And I walk up, they like all point their rifles at me. I'm like, no, it's okay. I got, no, who's your, I can't speak Spanish, blah, 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 blah. Long story short, somehow I convinced these guys to let us in. We have the whole field to himself and we do this whole shoot of him walking around Olympic Stadium, like empty with the torch going on in the background. We actually finish shooting. We go off, shoot a bunch of different stuff, interviews. We finish shooting about 2 o'clock. Now, he hasn't slept yet. The gold medal game is that night. He had been up all night before. And then the previous night, he had played cards pretty much all night. He might have gotten 1 or 2 hours sleep. So basically, he's been up for 48 hours straight. He's got the gold medal game, maybe 96 degrees and 100% humidity. Okay? He gets in his van. He goes, hey, can you do me a favor? Can you send somebody to get my clubs and drop me off at the golf course? I want to play. I want to get in 18. Before, and I'm like, look at him. I go, ha ha. I'm like laughing. Yeah, right. I think he's effing with me, you know? He goes, oh, no. So we get the clubs. We drop them off at the golf course. Now, this is in the sun. There's no shade at this freaking golf course. I am telling you, it's the hottest day. After being a 48 hours, shooting all day with us, playing up with this, he shoots 18 holes of golf. Okay. He hitches a ride back to the hotel at about 7-8 o'clock. He plays from like 3 o'clock to 7 o'clock, gets back to the hotel at 8 o'clock. The bus is leaving at 8:30 to the arena. Takes a shower, changes into his uniform and all his stuff, just barely makes the bus to the arena and plays the gold medal game that night.
Remarkable.
If there really ever was a mortal that was Superman, he's Superman. This guy. Nobody. I told Magic the story. Magic said I would have been dead. Anybody would have been. He goes, Michael's the only one who could have done it. He's Superman.
It just sounds almost unbelievable unless you were there and you were there.
No, really. The guy is Superman. He really is.
And then they go on and win the gold, and he's on next to no sleep over a couple of days. Phenomenal.
You know, and he had a pretty good game. He had like 22 points, and he had a pretty good game.
That footage, which at the time you're thinking, oh, it's great to get this, getting him walking around Barcelona. But all these years on, that footage is still iconic. And when he's walking through that Olympic stadium, and as you mentioned, how you've got the Olympic torch in the background and it shows MJ's face up close. I mean, there's some great footage there that all these years on, does it sort of make you proud that you're involved with that?
Yeah, you know, you live in the moment at the time. You don't sit there and go, oh, I'm 25. I want to look at this in 10 years, 25. But you know something big is going on. You know you're getting something good for the video at the time. And then obviously later on, all the documentaries that were made, you see it. And you know, and you see the photos and you just say, like, everyone in the world looks at that photo and, you know, I did that.
Mm.
I was part of that. It's like an out-of-body thing when you look back. You know what I mean?
Totally understand. And you mentioned how it showed that massive billboard of Jordan that's like 6 or 7 stories high in Barcelona there. How did you go about framing that shot?
I think it was Nike and his sponsors had put it up before the Olympics, before they got there, for good reason. And that was one of the shots that we had gone and rehearsed what we were going to do there, and depending upon the traffic. But we were there so early in the morning that it wasn't that bad. The good thing is we didn't have to walk the Ramblas, or we never would have gotten out of there. But Barkley used to walk the Ramblas every night. He didn't care. Yeah. Like, everyone was a prisoner but Barkley.
Yeah, he said to get out and about.
Charles was the star of Barcelona. He was always a basketball star at that point, but that's when he became a TV star, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. There's some great stories about Charles in Jack McCallum's book that you referenced about the Dream Team, about his exploits in Spain. Quite amazing when you look back.
When he elbowed the guy from Angola, but before the game, they said, well, what do you know? He goes, what do you think with this game coming up in Angola? He goes, listen, I don't know nothing about Angola. All I know is they in trouble.
One of the greatest quotes of all time.
Yeah. He was right. They were in trouble.
They were. I'd love to ask you about Come Fly With Me, which was the first release that you did with NBA Entertainment in 1989.
Still to this day, it's the biggest selling sports home video of all time.
Absolutely not surprised in any way, shape, or form. You were the executive producer.
And really had my hands in it. I took, you know, I didn't like to take multiple credits. I did a lot of the writing and directing and also obviously producing and stuff. But, you know, I had the first credit, so I thought that was plenty, you know.
Yeah, I watched it again last night just in anticipation of our chat today, and it is unbelievably great. I just love it, like millions of people who have watched it.
I mean, it's funny when you watch it. I mean, you know, it's produced almost, you know, it's 30 years ago. Some of the technology you have at your disposal now obviously would have made it a little easier. But yeah, for its day, it still holds up. It's a pretty damn good video.
Absolutely is. I absolutely love it. Could you have anticipated at the time, when it was released, the overwhelmingly positive response and just the, as you said, the best-selling sports video release of all time? How are you anticipating it when it was released?
I knew it would be good. I knew it would be really good because it's him, and I knew our production team was unbelievably capable. But then really when the story came together, I mean, it had some really good, you know, the whole idea that he was cut. That was our selling point. That was the thing a lot of people didn't know about at the time. And Michael Jordan got cut from his, you know, from the high school team. He was a freshman, and he got cut for this guy, Leroy Smith, famous guy that Michael still always used. He used to use the name Leroy Smith when he checked in hotel rooms and stuff.
Yeah.
It was his, like, AKA name. But it was funny. We were interviewing the high school coach. We went back to North, you know, to where we grew up, his high school and, you know, everything, his house and all that. And we're interviewing the coach, and I said, so tell me about it. You're the guy who cut Michael Jordan. Like, tell me that you cut, you know, tell me how you cut Michael Jordan. He goes, well, you got to realize at the time, you know, Michael was a freshman. There were a lot of players ahead and a lot of, and I'm like, okay. And I asked him again, so tell me why you cut Michael Jordan. And he starts beating around the bush. I say, do me a favor, okay? You will not make the video unless you say, yes, I am the coach who cut Michael Jordan. And then you can go on and tell me anything you want. So he smiles and he goes, yes, I cut Michael Jordan from the team. And then he went on and he goes, thank you. There's the line I needed.
That is so good. I absolutely love that.
Yes, I'm the coach who cut Michael as a sophomore.
He was like so ashamed, you know? Like, could you imagine? Like, that's the guy who told Babe Ruth, stick with pitching, don't become a hitter, you know?
That is excellent. I'm really glad that you shared that one. Thank you so much, because that's pretty much the first words you hear out of his mouth. I think Fred Lynch was his name.
Yeah.
You're the one there off camera asking these questions to the people that are being interviewed. Is that you mostly doing that?
Myself along with David Gavin, we both did a lot of questions.
Okay, okay. And then you also had a chat with, I think her name was Janice Hardy, the maths teacher from Jordan's high school, and she had an iconic line.
I told him to go in math.
Yeah, that's where the money was.
Yeah.
And I told him to go into math, but that's where the money was. Which I think's hilarious. He probably does too.
Some of the way that the video was scripted was just fantastic because you have Jordan's principal, I think his name was Kenneth McLaurin or something along those lines.
Okay.
He says something about how he suggested that the Air Force would be a great opportunity for Jordan to go into. And then the way it's scripted and the late Jay Thomas, who sadly passed away in 2017.
Yeah. Jay's a good friend. The reason he did that is because he was my good friend. It was very sad.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how it came to be to get Jay, because his voice is just perfect when you listen back to this footage all those years on. And he says something about, Michael would create his own Air Force.
This one-man squadron would eventually form his own Air Force, Air Jordan.
And it's just so iconic. So, yeah, do you mind us talking a little bit about Jay and the process of how he did the voiceover?
Well, I became friendly with Jay through, you know, he was doing a lot of New York radio. He was doing our voiceovers for some of our halftime features. And I got to know him, you know, on the New York circuit. And I was using him for a lot of voiceover. And I just said to him, I said, listen, we're doing the Michael Jordan, you know, biography tape. I said, you know, I could get some kind of guest, you know, how they always get some, you know, guy, you know, some movie star. Later on, he became a movie star. This is before he did TV. This is when he was just doing radio, Jay. And I just said, you know, I think your voice will be perfect for that. And he was like, oh, my God, I'd love to do this thing. And, you know, then Jay and I did that. And, you know, we were friends ever since. Did a bunch of other work with him. I used to play touch football pickup games with him.
Wow.
He was a crazy football fan and lover. He loved throwing the football.
Okay.
And, you know, he had a pretty good career.
Yeah. It's just sad that he passed away, obviously, way too soon, just last year.
Yeah.
In the late 1980s, NBA International was marketing the league across the globe. Here in Australia, it was in the early 1990s. I clearly remember staying up late of a night time and set the VCR to record the game of the week, which we'd watch the following day. What do you remember most about your involvement in getting the game distributed globally?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, when I started the NBA, we probably had a handful of countries. When I left, it was, oh my God, 100 and some odd countries that we were distributed in. I would say the McDonald's Open was a really good ambassador move by the NBA to play those games all over Europe and then eventually, you know, Asia, Africa, everywhere else. You know, having teams during the preseason play those games. I mean, you know, obviously you guys, obviously Luke Longley must have been a big star for you guys there and playing on the Bulls for those later championships.
Definitely was.
It was really, you know, during all the Olympics after the Dream Team, it really became a big thing. You know, obviously Petrovic and Vlade Divac were, you know, were critical. And, you know, along the way, guys, I mean, I love Petro. He was like one of my favorite players and people. He died tragically, obviously, in that car accident.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw Once Brothers. Have you ever seen that?
I did indeed. It was sad, but a really, really well done.
Really well done, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, and ironically, if you want to know this documentary, this, I'm not producing it, but, you know, I know the guys fairly well. Greg Winnick, who I hired and worked for me, and Mike Tolan is an old friend. They're doing these episodes of the Last Dance.
Yeah.
Ironically, if you want to know, it started at a McDonald's Open. The 1997 McDonald's Open in Paris, the Bulls were playing in Paris. Phil Jackson was there, and we all sat down and got together with Jackson and at the time, you know, David Stern and everybody else and talked about getting access and following the team throughout the 98 season and documenting it as like a last kind of show. And soon after that, I had left the NBA. 98 was my last season. I had left right after that. But I feel kind of cool because I was involved in the kickstart of that whole thing. And then they had the footage forever. They had amazing footage. I would follow it. I worked as a consultant for them after I left. And we'd looking at all this great footage that we shot and so forth. They kind of like played around with it, did a few things, but they kind of sat on it for 20 years. And now it's just coming out now. It's kind of crazy.
That is incredible.
I don't want to say if I would have been there, I would have gotten it out, but I don't know. Somehow it didn't get out.
20 years on. So you're referring to next year, there's going to be a 10-part documentary series on Jordan. It's titled The Last Dance, a collaboration between, I think it's ESPN Films and Netflix.
Yes.
Now, they mentioned there's something like 500 hours of never-before-seen footage, which was taken over that season primarily. Given your experience and history within NBA entertainment and what you know of those recordings, what are your hopes for the documentary, Don?
And just to show some unique access and to keep the storytelling alive. Don't lose track of a story. Everything is about, in our business, is about storytelling. You could do a 30-second spot or a two-hour film. Both have to have good storytelling. A good commercial means that there was a good story. A bad commercial means there was a bad story. A good movie means there was a good story. A bad movie means there was a bad story. Or it got lost somewhere in directing or writing or whatever. I just hope they don't overproduce, force the issue, overwrite it, and they kind of just stick to the key storylines and don't try to crowd in too much information and make it confusing. That's all.
Along with almost everybody that's a basketball fan, we're really anticipating something special when it does get released, so can't wait for that to come out. What do you recall of those promotional campaigns that you were talking about? NBA, it's fantastic, and I love this game. I don't know if one's more iconic than the other. I guess the I love this game was when the league was really taking off here in Australia in the early 1990s, probably 1992 onwards.
Yeah.
What do you recall about those?
I mean, the NBA's fantastic. We're basically using the great plays with music and then maybe having someone with a tagline. They were pretty simple. It was just taking the funniest moments, the greatest moments, the most intense moments, and putting them into a spot with the right music and the right tagline and doing it. I love this game. It became a little more, I wouldn't say sophisticated, but it became a little more of a campaign where we used celebrities and we used themes that the game itself was something to watch, whether it was played, how it was played at whatever level. And then you would have like a celebrity involved at the end who would kind of tag it off. You know, we had everybody from every wake of life involved in it.
Just some of the names I can recall are, well, Spike Lee, I'm sure, was involved. Jerry Seinfeld, Billy Crystal.
Right.
Who else? Sharon Stone, I think, was one of them.
Yeah, Rodney Dangerfield.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Yeah, there's some great ones. Kermit the Frog.
Yeah, we had everybody. We had, you name it, you know.
Hit it!
Happy feet. I've got those happy feet. Give them a low-down beat, and they begin dancing. 'Cause I've got happy feet.
I love this game.
We did a lot of those with an agency, could be Berlin and Silverstein initially, and then we kind of took it over ourselves. And then, you know, and then they started to migrate into other different spots. You know, a lot of the big thing that carried us were the public service announcements we did, because David always said one important thing: it's not what our fans think about us, it's what they feel about us. And they had to feel good about the players. We really shot very high-end film spots of them doing really good things in the community, talking about great causes, getting involved in public service. And we also, you know, ran the hell out of those. So it was really a combination. You had to make the people feel good about you also.
Just great memories from that time. And obviously the ad campaigns were certainly one way to help promote the game too. But really fascinating to hear this sort of backstory. I'd just love to quickly ask you about NBA inside stuff.
I get more people talking to me and asking me about NBA inside stuff more than anything I've ever been involved in my whole life.
Really? Wow.
The people that I've hired, the people that, a lot of people, you know, young kids, teens, grew up in the 90s, and it was the show.
Oh, it was the greatest.
It was must-see TV. It really was. Even the people in the television industry give us the credit. We were the first to marry music, sports, and lifestyle together. Then MTV started following with MTV Sports and then this and then that. We were the first ones to take lifestyle, take our NBA players, put them out into the general life, put them with musicians, put them with movies, put them off the field, put them in fun situations, and take an off the field, behind the scenes, all access look at our players in our game. And that show was a national show. It wasn't local, it was on a national basis. It was in the NBC lineup in the morning before Saved by the Bell. I worked with Brandon Tartikoff on the show. He was like the famous programmer at NBC. That really was the biggest moment that we changed. And I'll give credit to Dick Ebersol and to the NBC people at NBC Sports for pushing that, because when our contract ended with CBS, NBC bought the rights to the NBA in 1991. Mm-hmm. And we decided that we're going to take this sport and we're going to make it big and we're going to put it in prime time. That was for women, for kids, for teens, and basketball fans to get on board and to appreciate our players and our game. I would say we succeeded in more ways than we ever knew.
It's just great. Even to this day, I love watching old episodes online. I've got some on old videotapes too, if you can believe that.
I'll never forget coming up with the name in a meeting, and I think I blurted out inside stuff and it stuck. And I'll never forget, like, you know, the logo and the t-shirts, and now that's the inside stuff.
Yeah.
We had like all the players saying it, and it became such a part of American sports culture at the time. It was great. It's one of the things I'm most proud of. I really am.
And what about NBA action? How did that sort of come to be? That was maybe a year after, and it was a great sort of companion piece with Inside Stuff.
Yeah. Well, what happened was, you know, so we're doing all these shows and, you know, doing specials for NBC. And then we realized, you know what? We still got to take care of our hardcore fan and put it on cable and get it out there to the people that are watching sports 24/7. So we decided exactly what you said. We got to have a companion, top 10, top this, top that, all basketball all the time. And it was all voiceover, no on cameras.
Yeah, the great Jim Fagan, who sadly has passed away as well.
Fagan was our announcer for Inside Stuff also. He did the coming up next. We visit with, yeah, he was, Fagan was great. Yeah, the great Jim Fagan.
Not your normal features, not your normal announcers, not your normal sports show. But then again, who wants normal? NBA Inside Stuff, Saturday morning. Check your local listings.
Just fantastic to relive some of these times, and I really appreciate you making yourself available to do so today, Don. It'd be great to get you back at another stage to maybe talk a bit more about some of the other releases.
Sure.
Thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Adam. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. I welcome your interaction with the show. You can suggest topics or guests you want to hear conversations with. Leave a voicemail. Simply visit inallanis.com/voice. Click start recording. Leave your message and press stop. You can even listen back before submitting. Press send and you're done. Time to share another great review from a fan of the show. Thanks to Big Game Sanjeev, aka Sasha Giawadi. Hopefully that's close to how you pronounce your surname, Sasha. On the Australian iTunes store, the review is titled Highly Recommend, and it reads, an excellent podcast and highly recommended for any NBA fan with a respect for its history. Adam has had some amazing high-profile NBA and NBL players on his podcast, which is a true testament to his professionalism and quality of his work. Personal favourites include Bill Wennington, Andrew Gaze, Luke Longley, Sam Smith, and Peter Vesey. Keep up the great work, mate. Thank you very much, Sasha, or should I say Mauritian Ignition. Very kind words, and thank you again for adding your review, mate. I really appreciate it. Worldwide, the show currently has 75 reviews, 72 on iTunes and 3 on Stitcher. Thanks for your continued support. If you add a review, I'd love to read it out on a future episode. And as I like to say, your ratings and reviews are one of the best ways that you can support the podcast. If you enjoy the show, please tell your basketball-loving friends about it. Your word-of-mouth recommendations are worth their weight in gold. Stay up to date with my podcast and subscribe to my monthly email newsletter. You'll receive exclusive details on upcoming podcast episodes, future high-profile guests to appear on the show, and much more. Simply visit inallanis.com/news. You can subscribe to my show in various ways. Search for In All Airness, 3 words, on your podcast app of choice. The show is on iTunes, Spotify, Overcast, Pocket Casts, and more. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show and share my web address with your friends and colleagues, inallanis.com. Check out the podcast archive for plenty more episodes with high-profile guests. Follow me on Twitter at inallanis. Please add your like to the show's social hub, facebook.com/inallanis. Join me next time for another edition of the show.